This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The most common complaint I hear is this. There doesn't seem to be enough time for work and a life outside work. This is a particularly frustrating predicament for working parents who feel they're damaging their children by not spending enough time with them. Newsweek and U.S. News & World Report had cover stories on the subject this month. Each referred to a new book by my guest Arlie Hochschild called The Time Bind. Hochschild did a study of employees at a Fortune 500 company known for its family-friendly policies. She keeps the company anonymous, referring to it only as Amerco. It's an old cliché that men often seek refuge at work from the demands of the wife and children at home. Hochschild reports that's still true. What's changed is that now many mothers are also seeking refuge at work from the demands of family life.
Well, let me say at first that they didn't think they wanted to get out of the house. That, in fact, women are felt like they were just getting through the day. You know, it's not something they were thinking about. But when you ask them, where is it you feel appreciated? Where is it you feel really seen for your contribution? Where is it you feel good at what you're doing? And where are your friends and your social supports? They would often answer, at work. It's as if the village had gone to work. And when you ask them what it was like being at home, they would often say, God, there's a lot to do. One woman, for example, said, I come home and put the key in the door, and one child hasn't talked to anybody all day, another, the baby isn't in bed, the dishes are in the sink, and her husband has kind of felt like he was babysitting, he was waiting for her to come home, and as soon as she was home, it was all her job. And she didn't feel appreciated. She didn't feel valued. There weren't any recognition ceremonies for her at home. So it wasn't something that people were intending. It wasn't something that people were really conscious of. It wasn't a sort of a way of seeing family and home life that I think we've been aware of before. But this was a theme, that home had become a kind of a workplace. And for some of the people, some of the time, work had become a little bit of a home.
What were some of the things about work that made it seem more like home? And also, what were some of the things about work that made some people feel like they got more rewards, that work was the place where they felt more self-confident, that work was the place where they had an affirming network of people?
Well, this depends a lot on the workplace. It's not every workplace that's heaven, but it also depends whether you're a manager, a clerical worker, a production line worker. But among managers at a lot of Fortune 500 companies, there are new motivational programs, a total quality program, for example, that talks about valuing the individual and delighting the internal customer and so on. And there are a lot of recognition ceremonies and teams. You work in teams. So that the company actually thinks a lot about trying to make workers feel good. You know, they have gyms at work. As I see, this is a kind of an elite picture, but it created a kind of a managed atmosphere, that kind of managed cheer that was a relief to a lot of people. And even if people didn't like the content of their jobs, they had kind of lousy production level jobs, their pals were there, their flirtations were there, their friends were often there to talk in the break room with, have a beer after work with.
An interesting point you make. You say with so many marriages breaking up, it even seems that you can get your pink slip at home. Home doesn't mean security in the way that it once did.
Yeah, it's quite right that for a lot of the workers at this company, they'd been working at Amerco, the company I was studying, for 10, 15 years, but they were on their second or third relationship or marriage, so they were getting their pink slips at home.
Let's look more specifically at the company that you studied, that you based your conclusions on. It's a Fortune 500 company that you gave a pseudonym to protect their identity.
Right.
Tell us something about the company and the policies, the work-home balance policies that they initiated, which you studied.
Well, the reason I went to AmeriCo was because of these policies. It was a vanguard, family-friendly company that offered paternity leave. It offered part-time work with benefits and either temporary or permanent, offered job sharing. Two people could share one job, three people could share two. It offered flex time. You could come early and leave early or come late and leave late. It offered flex place. You could work from home part of the time or all of the time. So those were the policies that were on the books. And one of the big surprises and paradoxes was to realize that a lot of the families that I interviewed were working very long hours and needed time at home. And these were people with strong family values who wanted some balance in their life, were somehow shy about coming forward for these policies. And so that was kind of the what I didn't expect to find going in, but got haunted by and interested by coming out. You know, why? What was the obstacle in the way of achieving some kind of balance between work and family? You know, why? Why was this not working out in a company that seemed to promise good news on this score?
Do you think sometimes that although some companies will put policies into place that make it seem like you can work more at home or take more flexible hours, that the company might also at the same time really underestimate what it takes to do your job in an adequate way? And so in a way, they might be paying lip service to flexibility, but still requiring you to work really hard and really long hours.
I think you're completely right about that. For a lot of companies, family-friendly policies are a fig leaf on top of a highly workaholic culture from which the company gets a lot of benefit. But I am wondering, you know, where the stormtroops are. Where's the resistance to this? Who's coming forward and saying, you know what, this isn't working for us?
No, I think one of the things that makes an organized movement a little more difficult is that if you're talking about, say, a 9-to-5 job where you punch in on the time clock, you can say, well, we're working 8 hours and we ought to be working 6. But for a lot of, you know, management type people and, you know, people who have what's defined as like a professional job, you're not on the clock anyways. And it's kind of understood you're not getting overtime because you're a professional. And so you're just going to work as long as it takes to get the job done. And so getting the job done might require working till 10 at night, and you're not even going to get overtime for it. But it's accepted that's what comes with the position that you have, with the responsibilities you're given and the salary that you get. And it's hard to say, well, you want to work shorter hours because the hours aren't defined in the first place.
Right. I think that's right. But what if we work toward a system where someone who has, let's say, small children at home, or they have elder care, or they just want to grow their garden, say, look, you know, for a certain number of years, I want to go to 85%. That's not part-time. I'm not actually in favor of part-time. I'm for redefining what full-time is, mm-hmm. you know, and getting a variety of different kinds of work schedules to be normal.
So what's your interpretation of the reluctance of workers to use these policies that would enable them to spend more time at home?
Well, in addition to all the factors that we've talked about, I think there was one that nobody's been looking at, and that is a cultural shift that the village, in a way, has gone to work, and people's social supports are more now at work. And I guess that cultural shift expressed itself in a lot of different ways in all the interviews that I was doing at this company.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Arlie Hochschild, and her new book is called The Time Bind, When Work Becomes Home and Home Becomes Work. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Arlie Hochschild, her new book is called The Time Bind, When Work Becomes Home and Home Becomes Work. Your study is based on your observations at a Fortune 500 company, which will remain anonymous. This company had a daycare center so that parents could feel confident that their children were taken care of while they were at work. And it, of course, would enable parents to go to work and to work longer if they needed to. Tell us a little bit about how this daycare center worked and how many hours typically children spent there.
Well, it was a first-rate daycare center. The daycare providers there were well-trained and very responsive to the children. I couldn't think of a better childcare center, in fact. And but the hours were extremely long, anywhere from 8, 9 to 10 hours. So one thing I did was I hang out at the childcare center and watch parents bring their children and leave. And I would see parents come in and wave to the children with their keys in hands. And they would talk very briefly to the childcare provider. And then I would see them race for their car as they got out the door. So parents were sort of in a hurry as they dropped their children off at the childcare center, and they were in a hurry when they left as well. One got a sense of racingness. And in fact, when I was at the childcare center myself, sitting on a little toadstool chair, having just come from my own kind of racy work life, with, you know, faxes and email and stuff, I was sort of feeling speedy, and I sat down in this little chair, and I saw this little kid putting together a puzzle, and I thought, gosh, you know what? I could do that puzzle in a flash. I just put this little piece here and that little piece there, and I thought, my goodness, Arlie, you know, slow down. What this child is putting this puzzle together and needs time, and I realized that I would have to slow my own self down to a child's pace in order to study the kind of culture of time and speediness of the adult world that their parents were living in.
Well, I think one of your points here, too, is that it must be really hard to go from this speedy, insane world of work to then slow down and be at a pace that a child could comprehend, a pace that a child would work at.
Yes, that's right. There were certain islands of child time in this community. One saw them in a pediatrician's office or at a certain family-friendly restaurant and in parks. But very often at home, a kind of logic of efficiency had taken hold, again, without people thinking about it or meaning it to happen. But there were certain slots of time within which a bath had to be accomplished and a meal eaten and quality time, you know, done. And children were forever protesting these slots of time and trying to get some control of time. Because in a way, what had happened is a cycle had taken place. The more time is pumped out of home and pumped into work, the more starved for time people at home are, which makes life at home more of a strain. And so people go home to more of a strain and are more tempted to spend more time at work, which only makes the cycle go around again.
You say that families are actually following some of the same patterns as corporations now. For example, parents have to become time and motion experts, just scheduling everything, the lessons, driving children here and there, what time a meal is going to be, getting a kid off to school and all of that. And that parents are also starting to outsource some of their responsibilities, yeah, like corporations do.
Yeah, what are some of the things that, outsource. Yeah.
What are some of the examples of the downsourcing that you think parents are having to do now?
Well, downsizing, I think emotional downsizing at home has to do with redefining what our human needs are. You know, what is it, how much time do we really need with each other to have strong, spontaneous social relationships with one another? I think that's getting redefined down, even as kind of the demands at work are being beefed up. So this is one thing. At the same time, parents are tempted to kind of outsource a lot of different elements of parenting. For example, there are ads for experts that arrange your child's birthday party. They send out the invitations, they pump up the balloons, they buy little gifts for the guests, and they sort of do the party for you. And in a way, if you're really starved for time, you're very tempted, if you can afford it, to buy these services. But at the same time, this is yet another subtraction from what we've called family life. And then we wonder why it's hard for families to manage.
One of the things you found when you were interviewing people who work is that they had this kind of imaginary vision that they carried around with them, the person they would be if only they had time to be that person, the family they'd have if only they had time to be that family. What were some of these kind of potential selves, the imaginary selves that people carried around?
Right. This was one way that people evaded the time bind. They didn't really resolve it and try and change their circumstances, but they evaded it by unconsciously, I think, developing kind of potential selves. One man, for example, had bought a lot of camping equipment and this sleeping bags and freeze-dried food, and he had this plan, you know, what a good father he would be to take his two daughters on a camping trip. But that kept getting delayed and delayed and delayed again, and yet he lived with this sense of what a good dad he would be if only he had time. And a lot of the people that I interviewed had camper trucks that they hadn't driven. One had a sailboat, but they hadn't gone out sailing. Some people even had maple syrup making equipment, but they'd never used it to make maple syrup. We normally visualize a potential self as a way of getting in gear to act and get there, but these potential selves were instead of getting in gear to get there.
So just having the symbols around of what your life could be.
Right.
Did you find that those, the camper and the fishing gear and, you know, the maple syrup maker, were there as rebukes to people, objects that would always say, see, you'll never get to use me because you're just too busy? Or did they give any potential pleasure?
Well, they were there saying, gosh, you know, I'm still the kind of guy who has fishing gear. I'm still the kind of guy who has a camping truck. I have a life. And often people would have photographs of these objects and themselves in them, the one time they've used them in the last 7 years, kind of on the back behind them on the wall in their offices, kind of representing an ideal self that they like to think of themselves as, but it was sort of instead of becoming that real self.
The ironic thing here is that you studied a Fortune 500 company that you want to remain nameless to protect their identity, and they had this wonderful program of flexible policies so that people could spend more time at home, although a lot of workers decided not to take advantage of the policies. But anyways, by the time you were done writing the book, the corporation did away with a lot of these policies.
Yes, they did. They did. Which shows that it's not actually such a good bargain for people to make work into a home. Because it's a business, you know. It's out to make money. It better make a home a home.
But as you point out, people are getting divorced and fighting over custody of the kids. In a way, the picture that you're painting is of no security, no place.
You're talking to an optimist, and I say let's take it from here. And there are a lot of better models out there for the United States to look at. We can look to Sweden, for example, which has paternity leaves that are universally used by men. In fact, half of men take another parental leave in the child's first 2 years. I mean, these things seem amazing to the United States, but here's this advanced industrial nation, Sweden, that for whom this is part of the cake of custom. It's nearly half its labor force are women in substantial jobs, but it's a more family-friendly, child-friendly society. And I kept scratching my head as I listened to these poignant stories of these very good parents whose lives were really out of whack. I kept thinking, gosh, why couldn't we do it like in Sweden? What's stopping us? Maybe it's just not, you know, recognizing quite how far this has gotten. We've tended to normalize this imbalance. And I think, well, that's what families are like. Gosh, that's what jobs are like. There's nothing we can do about it. A lot of people feel that gosh, there's nothing we can do to change it. And you know, as someone who's been very active in the women's movement, I have a strong feeling there's a lot we can do to change this.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Arlie Hochschild's new book is called The Time Bind. I'm Terry Gross.